Welcome to the arena, where sometimes the hardest part is showing up. My name is Linda McLaughlin. Thank you for being here. It's been an interesting time these past 2 years. I've been lucky to meet some fascinating people while locked in Zoom rooms and in online communities. I try to find meaningful ways to interact, but sometimes I underestimate people. Cindy Villanueva is one such person. My curiosity one day about her story led to this conversation, and I think the question about joy and courage really gets to the essence of who she is. Before we begin, I gratefully acknowledge that I record this podcast on the First Nations territories of the Erie, Huron-Wendat, Haudenosaunee, Mississaugas, and the Chonodon of the so-called Neutral Tribes. Hamilton is also adjacent to the Haldimand Treaty Territory. Thank you for being here. This is episode 53. Any questions for me before we dive in and get started?
No, I've been listening to your podcast for the last
few days. Yes. Okay. It's always funny when I can see these random episodes that get downloaded. So it's quite a variety of people and their stories and what they bring to the table and what courage means to them. The answers are always a revelation in some ways. Right. Well, thank you for being here. I'm honored to be speaking to you. As I said to you before, with your story, I will admit that I took you at face value, which means that you're attractive, well put together, well spoken, highly educated. And that meant that I put a label on your forehead. Mm-hmm. And it's the classic story of don't underestimate someone's story and don't underestimate what someone's capable of and what they've had to do in order to be this person that you see before you. And it's a bit of an apology, to be honest, that I did underestimate you somehow.
Wow.
I didn't know your story. I didn't know who you were. I thought, okay, this is who this person is. And I, so anyway, that's,
Thank you for that. Thanks.
You're welcome. So I have my standard introduction, which I've cobbled together based on looking your website and obviously reading your book, Don't Fight Mad, which I thoroughly enjoyed and got a lot out of, just the way that you wrote it and offered some jumping off points, questions to ask as you lead the reader through the events in your life, but also the lessons I think that you gleaned from those experiences along the way. So let me start with that. Cindy Villanueva, you're a daughter, sister, mother, and grandmother. You're an author, consultant, entrepreneur, and public speaker. You're also a seventh degree black belt master instructor and the owner of a martial arts studio in Austin, Texas. Your parents were a mixed race couple in the early 1960s in Southern California, and they stressed to you and your brother the importance of education and growing up to be a good girl. You worked hard and were an A student. You had big dreams to be a lawyer and to enter politics, but instead, you became pregnant by a very troubled young man. You chose not to give up the baby, and it was one of many forks in the road in your life. While there are two failed marriages, physical injuries from your martial arts and financial troubles along the way, there are also triumphs and turnarounds. Your book, Don't Fight Mad, chronicles the many twists and turns of your life. You parallel what mixed martial arts taught you about digging in when you most wanted to give up. Welcome to the arena, Cindy.
Thank you so much. What a delight to be here. That was really a very comprehensive and very nice introduction. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Yeah, failed marriages sounds so simplistic compared to what you really went through.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't as though you hung in for 18 months and then went to the lawyer and said, okay, I'm done. You really dug in with both of those marriages and worked so much harder than it seemed your partners or your husbands of the time did. And a lot of that had to do with the love of your children and the life that you wanted to try and build for them.
Yes.
And the stability that you wanted to give them. I should say that you were, in fact, a teenage mother. It wasn't as though you were 25 and had gone through university. In fact, that derailed your academic life, becoming pregnant at a young age. Like I say, it was a revelation to read your book, and I thought you were so generous in the way that you laid it out and offered signposts along the way for people to take something from your experiences. So,
oh, thank you. I felt like that was really important. When I first started this book, I thought it was just this little self-help book. It was a six-step thing. The genesis of it was I had spoken at University of Texas, their Graduate Women in Business, and I'd done a keynote for them, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And it was just a room full of women, recently graduated MBAs, and they invited me because I'm a martial artist and a woman 7th degree black belt was a cool thing, I think. And so I had done a thing on resilient leadership, and I'd used these 6 steps and compared it to martial arts. And at the end of it, I had several women come up and say, oh my gosh, you should do a TED Talk, you should write a book. And I always had rattled around in my head. And so when I started the project, I really thought of it as this short little 6-step book. But the more I wrote, the more I brought in my own personal experiences as examples. And then people who were reading it would say, oh, I want to hear more about that. Tell me more about that. What was the genesis of that particular activity or that response? Or, and so as it blossomed, it ended up where I thought, I think I'm writing a memoir. And
right.
Yet I still wanted to do this self-help piece of it. So I ended up writing the first section of the book, which was just memoir, and talked a lot about my parents, what you talked about. And then the 6 steps ended up turning into 7 steps. But then once I got to that point, it didn't feel like it was finished. And so the third part of the book really is inspiration. And it's around the idea that when we've gone through something and we've come out on the other side, a lot of times we want to just put a bow on that box and stick it on a shelf someplace and never look at it again because it was traumatic or it was ugly or whatever. But I really believe that it's almost a necessity for us then to take it and use it for somebody else's good, because somebody else could use a hand up. Somebody else could use some insight that they haven't yet gleaned in the midst of their circumstances. And it's not like you can take away the bad times that someone else has experienced, but you can give them hope. You can give them inspiration. You can give them comfort, whatever. And I really started to feel like I'm being selfish if I don't share this. Mm. And I tend to be a very private person. And so writing this, I really had a lot of angst about, oh my gosh, I've just like completely ripped open and shared all this personal stuff. But to have people who've read the book and come back and said, oh my goodness, thank you so much for sharing that. Or like you were saying, the writing prompts at the end of the section, the middle section around the self-help piece of it that helped people to get through things. That to me has been just hugely rewarding.
Where does the expression don't fight mad come from?
Yeah, that was actually something that happened to me when I was a blue belt. So well before I turned black belt. I'm very competitive, and every
really?
Single time, hard to believe, but it's true. Every time I would spar, if somebody would score on me, I would get so angry and I would just go, oh, I'm going to go that much harder. I'm going to punch harder. I'm going to go faster. I'd get mad. And I had an instructor who stopped me and he said, Cindy, don't fight mad. When you fight mad, you don't see what's coming and you miss opportunities. And that has stuck with me now for 25 years. It's such a good life lesson. And it's not just anger, right? It's any of those negative kind of emotions that take us away from being our best. So maybe it's resentment, it's bitterness, it's lack of forgiveness, it's fear. Any of those kinds of emotions, if we act out of those emotions, we're never going to be at our best. So how do we overcome those things? For me, therapy is part of it. part of it is one of the delights of owning a studio. I have a bad day. I get through my day. Everybody leaves. I lock the door. I turn the stereo up full blast. I put my boxing gloves on and I go to town. And after 10 3-minute rounds, I'm dripping sweat and all is right with the world. So it's finding ways to eliminate those kinds of negative emotions. And it's not being Pollyanna. It's not pretending that things aren't bad, but it's not allowing them to consume me and force me to make decisions or actions that do not serve me well and that are not really reflective of who I am. If I'm fighting mad or I'm fighting out of bitterness or resentment or I'm holding a grudge against somebody, it doesn't hurt them. It hurts me. And now I'm not acting in the authentic me. And now I'm going to wake up tomorrow and I'm not going to be proud of the life that I just lived.
And being in the right arena is also something that you talk about.
Yeah. When you think about martial arts, if I go to a tournament, now I have a black belt, I have 7 stripes on my black belt. I'm a master instructor. But if I go to a tournament, I guarantee you, I am not going to sign up for the men's heavyweight black belt division. It's not my ring. I could be fighting against somebody who also has a black belt, but if he's a foot taller than I am and he outweighs me by 50 pounds, I'm not going to win. Maybe I'll score a couple times, but I'm not going to be successful because it's not my ring. That's not my division. Likewise, I'm not going to go sign up for the white belt little dragons division. They're 4 years old. They're just starting martial arts. It's going to be way too easy and it doesn't challenge me. So I find my division, which is the women's advanced black belt division in my weight class. And now I know that I'm going to be pushed. I'm going to be challenged, but I also have a chance to succeed. So finding your right ring is really important. It's not putting yourself in situations where you can't fail, because that never feels good. And it's also not putting yourself in situations where you're not going to find joy. And one of the things I've often said is you'll find people who are in, for example, a certain profession because their parents said, you've got to be a lawyer, you have to be an accountant, you have to be a doctor, whatever. And so they go through all of that. They go through all the schooling. They're in it. They've been in that career for 20 years and they're miserable because really what they wanted to do was be a painter or a yoga instructor or whatever. And so it's a matter of finding out and being ruthless with yourself and saying, does this bring me joy? Or is this something that I do because I've always done it, because I was told this is what I ought to do? Find the place where you truly are going to succeed and be challenged. And then do what you need to do to get into that ring. You don't just quit your job and go try to do something new. But for me, getting back into the ring meant, okay, I dropped out of college when I was 19. I was dabbling. I was taking classes all through the years. But finally, when I got divorced the first time, it's like, okay, I got to keep a roof over my head. I need a decent job. I got to go back to school. And so I went to school at night, worked all day long, took care of my boys. Rebecca had left by that point, but I didn't get my bachelor's degree till I was 40. I got my MBA when I was 50. You know, Rebecca got her master's degree before I did. So that was part of, for me, getting back in the ring was one of the things that I need. For me, it was academic. But for other people, it could be something else. Maybe you need to take a painting class. Maybe you need to adopt a meditation practice. Maybe you need to go on a world tour. Whatever it is, figure out what you need. What are the things that are going to prepare you to get into the right ring so that you're not just spinning cycles in the wrong ring, either getting beat up or having success that you don't feel good.
Right. It's too easy. There's no real reward to it.
Yeah, precisely.
Talk to me about discovering joy. You talk in your book how you would see these home movies of this young girl running around and just full of life and joyful.
Yeah.
And there were various steps along the way where that joy was non-existent, was robbed from you. You let it go in a way based on the choices that you had to make in your life to stay with the husband who was abusive, no good. Because again, the underestimation of the person I see in front of me is extremely joyful. My interaction with you has always been, you are this shining light in the community that you and I have interacted in. And so my assumption is that's just Cindy and life has been good and she's successful. All of those layers of the story that I bring to you. But it's been truly a battle to bring yourself back to that joy.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was little, I was really fortunate. I was raised in this very loving, wonderful home. And both my parents and then my younger brother, who's 2 years younger than I am, my mom, there's nothing more important to my mom than her kids. And I was actually, I have to say, I was really touched listening to your one episode with the woman who had suffered the 2 miscarriages. Mm. My mom had 10 miscarriages. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And finally, she got to the point where the doctor said, you simply cannot do this again. And she had a hysterectomy. But both my parents came from large families. They came from 6 kids each. They wanted a big family. Both of them had come from very hard situations. My mom had a terrible relationship with her parents and was the kid who was routinely just dismissed and unloved. And she wanted to build that family and devote herself to her kids. My dad came from a very difficult life where they were, if you've ever been to like Baja California and you see the on the sides of the hillsides where there's houses that are built with corrugated tin or cardboard or that kind of thing. That's how my dad grew up. And then they would travel to Central California to pick cotton or vegetables or fruits or whatever. And then they would go back to Mexico and back and forth. And so just abject poverty. And when my dad was 16, he said, enough, I'm not living this life. And they lived in the camps, no running water, no indoor plumbing. And my dad said, enough. And his father said, no, you're going to stay. They had made him drop out of school when he was in the 8th grade because they said, that's enough education. We need your hands in the field. And so my dad left home at 16 and he moved to Los Angeles and, you know, lived with a cousin and worked 2-3 jobs sometimes. When I was really little, he worked 3 jobs. So I grew up in a family where family was everything. They just doted on us kids. And so we had no idea. You know, we had this beautiful, happy-go-lucky, wonderful life with 2 parents who adored us. And so I see these movies and it is always my brother James and me out running, playing with the dog. And I was constantly running circles wherever I was. I would, and then I would stop and dance and I would smile at the camera. And yeah, I look at that little girl and I think there was a time when I really wondered what happened to her. And I can say that probably the very beginning of the killing of the joy in me was when I was in the 5th grade. I was that stereotypical fat girl. I was really overweight. I had braces. I had kinky curly hair when everybody else wanted the Marsha Brady straight blonde hair. I wore glasses. And that year I had to get braces and I had to wear headgear and I had to wear it 17 hours a day. So that meant wearing it to school. And also that year I got chickenpox. And I got to the point where I was pretty much over it, but still had some of the scabs and the doctor said, no, you're not contagious. You can go to school. So my mom said, okay, go to school. And so I went to school and I kept my hair across my face because I had still scabs on my face. And I came home and I remember sitting on the counter in my bathroom, purposely picking the scabs off my face so that I wouldn't have to go back to school because the kids made fun of me. And I literally have 2 chickenpox scars on my face right here because I picked them off of my face because I was so embarrassed. That year was a horrible year and was absolutely transformational for me in a terrible way. I was bullied terribly. And you talk about being highly educated and being a great student. Yeah, I was that brainiac where everybody wanted to sit by me so they could copy off my papers or whatever, but I was just a complete outcast and made fun of. And it was horrible. It was really everything I think about my personality flipped that year. And I became very quiet and private and shy. And I would purposely make mistakes on tests so that I wouldn't be a straight A student. Everything completely changed for me. And so I think that kind of carried on through my adult life until I was late in high school when I had gotten back to more of who I was. You know, I was getting straight A's. I was captain of the swim team. I was the editor of the school paper, all that kind of stuff. And I got a big scholarship to UCLA, and I was starting to change. But I got involved with a boy who was absolutely 100% the opposite of me, came from a alcoholic family, was abused. He, you know, drank every day. He smoked weed. I'm 60 years old. I've never been drunk in my life. I've never smoked weed. But he was the absolute opposite of me. And so I had this sort of dual life where I was trying to succeed and excel. And then I'm involved with this kid. And so my freshman year, I go off to UCLA. But of course, he comes to LA and visits me. I'm living in San Jose. And I got pregnant my freshman year. And I quit school and came home and had a baby. And then it was kind of like, your life is over. You gave it a try and it's not going to work. And I ended up living with him. We didn't get married. We lived together. Rebecca was born. She was born premature. And we're young. Like I turned 19 a week after she was born. 9 days after she was born, I turned 19. He is 19. He didn't go to college. He's working. I don't know what he was doing. Some menial kind of a job. And we're trying to pay bills and pretending to be grownups. And of course, his background, highly abusive, alcoholic, and I'm being abused. And at that point, my self-esteem was so bad. I really felt like I had thrown away this wonderful life and this is what I deserved. And I say that and I just cringe because that sounds so sick. And it really was. But that's really where I was. I just felt that's what I deserved. And then there was one day when he hit me and I was holding my 3-month-old and something just clicked. And it was like, you know what, Cindy, you maybe are going to be stupid enough to stay here and take this, but there's no in hell that you are going to put your child in this kind of danger. And I left the next day. I wish that I could say that I had enough self-love that I would have done it for myself. And at the time, I just didn't. I'm very thankful I cared enough about Rebecca that I was able to get out. And I know there's a lot of women who don't have that experience.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm just going to take you back a little bit because the relationship that you had with your parents and their demonstration of being that loving family, there's also your father who really demonstrated his own level of, his own story is phenomenal. Like you say, going from Baja and living in abject poverty to working multiple jobs and getting himself all the way to IBM. So take me back to dinner conversation in your household. What was it like growing up?
Oh gosh. So my dad, because he had to drop out of school when he was in the 8th grade, education was everything in our household. It was just, that is how you were going to make it out. That's how you were going to succeed in life. And so we always had to talk about what we learned in school that day and what kind of work we were doing. And we had these games that we played at the dinner table where, and I can still do it today. So my dad would give us a list of 10 words. And before we ever started it, we had to memorize words that rhymed with 1 through 10. So 1, run, 2, shoe, 3, tree, 4, yeah, right up through 10. So once we had those memorized, then we got to start playing the game. So he would come to the dinner table with a list of 10 words. So let's say the first word was book. He would say 1, book. 2, lamp. And then he would say the whole list. But he would give us a second. So we would think 1 is book. Okay. 1 is run. So you would close your eyes. And for me, I would picture a book with legs running down the street. And so you would associate it with the word that you already had memorized. And then we'd go about dinner and we'd be chit-chatting and he'd say, Cindy, 6. And I think, okay, 6 is sticks. Okay. That word was pineapple, whatever. And so we would play these word association games. Yeah, it's funny now. It was like, it was a thing because he was always making sure that we were working our brains. In some way, we were working our brains. That was dinner at our house. Oh, and the biggest part of dinner at our house was Cindy put the book away. No reading at the table. But it was always the 4 of us at the table and mom cooked. We set the table. We had dinner. We cleared the table. James and I washed dishes while she and my dad visited. And then I will say, when we turned 9 years old, we were responsible for dinner one night a week. And so we would tell our mom what it was that we wanted to cook. I can remember checking out from the library, the Betty Crocker cookbook for children. We would find recipes and then my mom would buy whatever we needed at the grocery store. And then James and I would cook dinner. And those were the nights that my mom would clean up and set the table and stuff because we would do it. And this is a funny story. I remember one time when my brother, he must have been 8 or 9, helping me, and he was going to do dessert. And so he had this great idea that we were going to have oranges. And so he sliced them in half and then set them in a bowl, and he wanted to decorate them. And so he took food coloring and squirted it on it. But of course, it dilutes in the orange juice. So they looked like those 1,000-year-old eggs that turn like greenish brown.
It's like, oh, no.
Trust me, they taste good. They're oranges. They just look funny. And my parents dutifully ate their oranges.
Oh, man. Yeah. Oh, God, I can only imagine what that would turn into, especially with the acid and the, anyway.
Yep. Oh, good times.
It's one of those classic, you'll never live it down kind of stories. Yeah. So what event in your life has had the most profound impact on you?
You know, I heard you ask that to everybody, and I've been thinking about that a lot. And there are a number of them, but I would say one big one was getting pregnant with Rebecca. That was such a turning point for me. You know, I was really on this trajectory. I think I wrote about it in the book. I had this whole 15-year life plan. I knew exactly what I was going to do. I'm going to UCLA, majoring in political science. When I graduate, I'm going to come back to Northern California. I'm going to go to law school. And I had my favorite uncle was an attorney in Beverly Hills. And I just idolized him. And I thought, I'm going to go work with Uncle Kenny. And I'm going to have this great career. And then when I turn 35, I'm going to run for the Senate. And I'm going to be a senator from California, and had the whole thing mapped out. And now all of a sudden, guess what? I'm having a baby. And I have no idea what to do. I never wanted kids. I never wanted to be married. I had, like I said, I had the game plan, and it did not include parenting. And now all of a sudden I have this pregnancy, and I'm really unsure what to do. And then, of course, everything falls apart with my parents. They throw me out. I'm living with this boy and having this baby. But then once I had her, oh my gosh, it's everything that I saw with my mother and how she was with her family is exactly what I feel. I've had people ask me before, describe who you are. And the first thing that comes to me is I'm a mom. It doesn't matter how many books I write. It doesn't matter, you know, how much speaking I do, how many black belts I train. At my core, the most important thing to me is being the mother to these 4 kids. That's absolutely the most important thing to me. So I would say that's probably really the pivotal thing. Like I said, 5th grade was horribly traumatic. I think at 60 years old, I probably still have some things that I deal with. And I've certainly worked through a lot of it in therapy. Having to turn your entire personality 180 degrees was very traumatic. But that tipping point, I think, for me was having my daughter.
And what does it mean to live a courageous life to you?
Yeah. Courage to me is not pretending that you're not afraid. There's lots of things to be afraid of. Anytime you try something new, you can be afraid. Courage to me means finding the motivation to go forward even when you're afraid. I think part of it is being really stubborn and refusing to give in, refusing to be defeated by that, because I always think about, how am I going to feel tomorrow if I didn't push through? One of the things I tell my black belt students, and it's one of the things that I thought about when I got my first degree black belt. It's a 2-day test. When I wake up in the morning on Sunday, I do not want to have a single regret. I don't want to think, man, if I had only known we were only going to spar 5 rounds, I would have gone harder. I would have left it all out on the mat. I wanted to wake up Sunday morning and know that there was absolutely, unequivocally, non-negotiably, not a single thing that I could have done more of or done better or given more of myself to. That for me is courage, because you don't know if it's going to be 10 sprints or 30. You don't know how this particular thing is going to work out, this relationship, this business proposition, whatever it is. If I leave, if I stay, if I try this, whatever, there's new things that we can come up against every single day. But I always try to think, what am I going to feel like the next day? What do I want to feel like? The next day, I want to be proud of how I showed up. I want to be proud of who I was in that moment. And then I work back from there. You do what has to be done. You kick, you scream, you cry, you do whatever you got to do. I'm always thinking about, how am I going to feel tomorrow? And then I work back from that.
I just want to insert joy for courage. And how could we pursue joy in the same way that we approach courage?
I think the first step is that you have to believe that you deserve it. Because I think for so many of us, we just don't. And we are satisfied with happiness. And it's not the same thing. It is absolutely not the same thing. Happiness is transient. I can be happy one second and be unhappy the next second. Joy is entirely different. Mm. And joy stems, I think, from living by your values, by living that life that you can really be proud of, and finding the simplest things. I don't have to have big accolades or a ton of money or sell a million books. All of that would surely make me happy. Yeah, of course I'd be happy. But if it disappeared the next day, I'm going to be unhappy. Where do I find joy? I find joy in deep relationships, living a life that I can be proud of, things that bring me to tears. I think about my grandchildren. I think about my children. I think about women I've worked with at my studio. Like, I love seeing the little kids. Yeah. How do you not love seeing the little kid out there? That's adorable. But where I derive joy is when I see a woman, like, I started martial arts when I was 32. If I see a woman who comes in here and says, hey, I've always wanted to try this. Do you think I could do it? And I say yes. And I get her on the mat and I teach her a couple of things. And in 6 months, all of a sudden, you know what? Her body's changing. The way she stands changes. The way she talks to people changes. All of a sudden, there's a degree of confidence that she has. And it's not like she's out there being a badass trying to fight with people and stuff. But there's something that has changed in her. And I know that I had a piece in that, that brings me joy. That brings me joy. So I would say, number one, you got to believe that you deserve it, because we do. We all deserve to live lives of joy. Forget about happiness. Think about joy. And then secondly, start living according to your values. And if you don't know what they are, do an audit. Figure it out. What's really, truly important to you? And when you can live a life every single day that, I mean, we all screw up, but when you look back at that day, I lived a life that I can be proud of, that will bring you joy.
What would you do on your last day?
I'm going to come back to the mom thing. I would want time with my kids. I would want, and I was actually thinking about this question yesterday. A year ago, right before Christmas of 2021, my older son, James, has two dogs, and one of them had gotten sick right before Thanksgiving, and it ended up, he had pancreatic cancer. And he got really sick over the next month, and we did blood transfusions. We were feeding him baby food, and he just continued to get sicker and sicker. And finally, the vet was saying, it's time. And where I live at in Florida is across the street from the beach, and Bruiser used to love to go to the beach. And so that morning we...
Bruiser is his name?
Bruiser's his name. Yeah. Okay. And it gets better. So these dogs, this is crazy. These dogs are half Shih Tzu, half Rottweiler. And it's even weirder than that, because the dad is the Shih Tzu. So the people... who had these two dogs. They never got them fixed because they were like, oh, this could never happen. And then it happened and they had these babies. And so James ended up with two of them. So Titan and Bruiser. And they have, they're absolutely adorable dogs. So Bruiser gets sick. And we scheduled for the vet to actually come to our home. And we bundled him up because he was just skin and bones. We bundled him up that morning and we took him across the street to the beach. And we laid him on a blanket. We just loved him and hugged him and talked to him and told him how much we loved him. And just, it was my son James and my son Alex and me with Bruiser. And then we went back to the house and our other three dogs got a chance to just lie down next to him and snuggle with him. And then the vet came over. And so it was as beautiful as a horrible situation can be. That's what I want. It's got to include the beach. And it has to include my kids. And for me, that I can't even imagine a more joy-filled day.
Mm. Beautiful. I think we were talking previously how we gift a good death to our animals, but
yes,
we can't seem to quite get it together fully for human beings, which is really unfortunate.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I agree.
We place more emphasis, I think, for human beings on existing for another day and getting to another day, which if my last 10 years is going to be in a hospital bed, no thanks.
Yeah,
and I'm really fading mentally and all that. It's no, but we don't know. And we always place so much trust in medicine to make us better, and one day we'll walk out of here, and all that, all of those stories that are told. And it's just interesting. It'll be interesting to see whether we can figure that out in our lifetimes. So,
yeah, I agree. Anyway.
And what's your legacy?
I hope my legacy is love and encouragement and inspiration, that the people I come in contact would walk away feeling that they had been really seen and heard and loved and supported and encouraged. I think with my kids, and I have told them so many times, I believe in you. I don't just love you. I like you. I see such good in you. What can I do to help bring that out in you? Just encouraging them and supporting them. But I do that here at my studio too, with students who maybe are unsure or lacking confidence. I want to show them what's in them until they can see it for themselves. It's really important to me. I think back, my mom did that for me. She always believed in me. She was my number one cheerleader, and I miss her so much. She died 10 years ago. If something good happens, the first thing I want to do is pick up the phone and call my mom. If something bad happens, the first thing I want to do, pick up the phone and call my mom. And that would be the legacy. If I had a legacy like that, the people, when they were with me, that they felt like I was genuinely present and that I brought out the best in them, that would be a legacy I would be very proud of.
From my experience of you, you're living your legacy.
Thank you.
And if you had the opportunity to have a conversation with someone for 5 minutes, who would that be?
Oh, my mom. Easy. Yeah. Five more minutes with my mom, for her to just tell me how much she loved me, how much she believed in me. Just to sit and have a cup of coffee with my mom for 5 minutes, would be wonderful. She was such an amazing woman. She was definitely a woman of her time. She was born in 1939. She did rebel like crazy to marry my dad. That was like the big thing she did. But other than that, she was very traditional. She was a stay-at-home mom. I can remember her working part-time a little bit when we were older. But when we were younger, my mom was the mom that all the kids wanted to come to our house, because, you know, we didn't do store-bought cookies. Everything was homemade, and she was just that mom. She was mom to everybody. And but even still, she was the one who always told me, you can do anything. You can be anything.
The grit of a woman who had 10 miscarriages.
Oh, God, yeah.
Married a Mexican gentleman, and you shared in the book the racism that they experienced as being a mixed-race couple in California, and you definitely got her backbone and a willingness to stare in the face of adversity and keep moving forward.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I would agree.
Anything else you want to share before we wrap up?
No, I just want to say thank you so much. This has been really delightful, and it's been quite an honor to be a part of your journey. And I love your podcast, and
thank
it's
you.
Been really nice. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm so grateful to Cindy for sharing her story with us today. I should also mention that Cindy is working on her first work of fiction and is already thinking about a sequel. After our conversation, I found this quote from Karen Solomson. Often, it's the deepest pain which empowers you to grow into your highest self. Thank you for listening. I'm so grateful to have you here. Who in your life needs to hear this story today? Please share it with them. And to find Cindy and her book, I'll put her social media and website details in the show notes. To find other episodes of The Arena or to contact me directly, please go to the website, thearena-podcast.com. Until next time, my name is Linda McLaughlin in The Arena.